It's been a long week, hasn't it? We talked about an overcrowded Atlanta, competitive lying, and the coming crisis in Georgia libraries. Now it's time to sit back, relax a little, and celebrate Friday. Let's head into the break room.
Diversity means the times are changing. And with that in mind, Ron, are you paying attention?
Nope.
Well, this concerns all of us.
Okay.
I want to say to each of you, simply and directly, I am deeply sorry for my irresponsible and selfish behavior.
Christy, if you saw it, he had a really zoned out expression on his face. He looked like he wasn't entirely comfortable standing behind Trump. He almost looked like he was in a hostage situation.
Well, we've got a break room gang hostage today. Amber Scott is executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. Hi, Amber.
Morning.
Tamika DePriest, marketing and communications strategist. Good morning, Tamika.
Good morning.
Jeff Breedlove is the communications director for the DeKalb County Commissioner, Nancy Jester.
Good morning.
To see you.
Yeah. Good morning.
And Bea Wynn is the executive director for the nonprofit Athena's Warehouse. Welcome back, Bea.
Thanks,
Celeste. It's been a little while.
I know.
It's good to see your face again.
Thank you.
So let's start off with something depressing. Atlanta has long been called the city too busy to hate. It's something we're proud of. But a recent study of social media found Atlanta is actually the second most sexist and racist city in the country after New Orleans. The study was conducted by the website Oboto.com. It cites frequent use of language that was both anti-black and derogatory against women by Atlantans on all forms of social media. When I tweeted about this morning, somebody immediately tweeted back. Anthony Christ tweeted back, HB 757 won't help that image, which is, of course, the law, the religious liberty bill. But I wonder if this surprises anybody else. Amber?
Yeah, I mean, surprising, not so much, but very disappointing. But, you know, I think a lot of it has to do with people are really comfortable behind computer screens. And so things that they wouldn't say in public with their name to it, they'll
but
say.
But isn't that true in any city?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I mean, Atlanta, I'm not sure why
Atlanta.
So many people. Yeah.
It was surprising to me. I mean, when I think about the fact that this is the city that has had its first female mayor, African-American female mayor, several black mayors. When you look around the leadership quadrants, you know, whether it's corporate or, you know, governmental, it doesn't really matter. You see a lot of, you know, diverse leadership. Yes, diversity. And so it runs counter to that optic, right? It's like, but, you know, what was even more surprising for me is that as we moved outside of the Metro Atlanta region and sort of looked at this from a state perspective, tolerance rose. So that's what was surprising to me in a state that wouldn't elect Andrew Young governor after he brought the Olympics here. So I don't know. Surprising and confused.
Confused. Jeff?
Well, I mean, I reject the whole premise of the study. First of all, I'm a native of Atlanta. I was born in Atlanta. And that's not the city that I know. And I think you have to look at, it's a group that I think most people in Atlanta have never heard of. And, you know, you got to get to how they define their terms. You know, what is anti-black? What is anti-woman? Is it anti-black to comment that you don't agree with Black Lives Matter, for example? If they define that as anti-black, since they've been in the news a lot, they could tally a bunch of comments and say, we define that as anti-black because if you disagree with that movement, you're anti-black. So we don't know how they define the terms anti-black and anti-woman. If you disagree with abortion, is that an anti-woman comment? And those comments could be made by pro-life women. So we don't know what they mean by those terms. I think Atlanta is so much bigger, so much more diverse than one study by a group that most people haven't heard of.
They actually didn't use things like Black Lives Matter. They looked for things, terms I cannot use on the radio, that have. I think everyone here would agree that they are anti-black because I can't say them on the radio.
Well, I think the other thing disturbing about a study like this is also where's the study on quotes that were anti-conservative, or quotes that were anti-people of faith. So, you know, we can define ourselves the way that we can allow ourselves to be defined the way that any group with an agenda wants to define us. As a person that lives here every day, I mean, look at the room we're in. It's a very diverse room. Atlanta is
by design, though.
Well, sure. But, and by voluntary participation also. I mean, Atlanta's not that. And that doesn't define us as a city. We're a much better city than these people are trying to portray. And I don't think I submit no one working and living and playing in our city today lets a study like that by a group like that impact how we feel about each other.
I'm thinking about the fact that Trump
won
here in Georgia. And I think some of his rhetoric, which I think we would.
But he's won in lots of places. I mean, we're going to have to move on. So let me
to weigh in. I think that Atlanta is very diverse. And I think that is particularly why people are vocal about things like that. We have situations in other cities, and particularly the North, where race is very different, and people are much more able to stay silent and not voice things. But here in Atlanta, where we do have the intersection of race and gender, and we do see women and people of color in political leadership, and we have to interact, that's where people start feeling uncomfortable and their feathers get really ruffled. And so while I think that we are diverse, yes, we are, I think that we have... we are progressive, but I think that progress is what challenges people to really come out of the woodworks and be vocal about how they feel.
It can be difficult. And Jeff, before we move on, Jeff, you'll have to check your Twitter when we get back, because Reverend Joel Tolbert tweeted, Jeff, head in sand, ? So you can respond to the Reverend when we get done. But let's move on. None of us here are actually of retirement age, unless you look great. But if we were, are you actually ready to retire? It turns out a lot of Americans don't actually have a lot in savings.
Kenneth, how much money do you have in your savings?
Well, let's see. $80,000.
If you don't include Confederate money.
$4,000.
A new study from the Government Accountability Office found for retired Americans, that's ages 65 to 74, over half of them have no savings at all. Thoughts?
Scary.
Yeah, scary, right?
But not surprising. So the Annie E. Casey Foundation released a report recently that said 47% of Americans cannot handle a $400 emergency.
Yeah.
So it's not surprising.
But this
it's
is scary for the country, is it not?
It's very scary.
It is. And it reminds me of hearing constantly over the years that at some point Social Security would not be able to cover all that it should in terms of sheer numbers of people because of the growing reliance on it as a major source for retirement income versus, retirement savings.
Right, a 401k.
401k.
There's very few regular pension programs left in the country.
Absolutely.
But, I mean, this is something I think the country needs to grapple with.
Absolutely. As a millennial, I was really surprised because I felt like everyone was constantly telling me, save for retirement. And now it seems like that was very much do as I say, not as I do. When so many of the older generation, I think, said 50% only have savings. And so, yeah, it's really shocking. What do these people plan on working forever? Or,
some of them had to pay for their kids' college educations, which is an entirely different conversation.
It's very scary. My wife and I were at the Varsity a couple of days ago, and we had to have a reality check on, as we're turning 50, what position are we going to be in? And we had to adjust some of our personal spending. It's also something that I wish both the Republican Party and Democratic Party would take more seriously in Congress on Social Security and Social Security reform, and how are we fair?
It's too bad it's been politicized.
How are we fair to the older generation, but how do we take care of the younger generation? We've got to have it for us.
Well, it is Friday. We are hanging out in the break room. You can join the conversation now on Twitter at OST Talk. Just ahead, we talk about the curious case of Chris Christie going all in on Donald Trump.
Donald and I, along with Melania and Mary Pat, have been friends for over a decade. And over the years, we've had a lot of wonderful times together.
This is On Second Thought. I'm I'm Celeste Headlee. This is On Second Thought, and we are hanging out in the break room. We've got Amber Scott with us. She's executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. Also, Tamika DePriest, marketing and communications strategist. Jeff Breedlove, of the communications director for the DeKalb County Commissioner, Nancy Jester. And B. Wynn is with the nonprofit Athena's Warehouse. And we want to say a special thank you to those people who have provided our coffee this morning. Savannah Coffee Roasters donates the coffee that fuels me and the rest of our break room guests' brains. You can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. All right, let's talk about disgracing yourself. For big companies, the right celebrity endorsement can really take their product or their service to the next level. But if that endorser then ends up on the wrong side of the law or morals, there can be big PR consequences.
Hey, y'all, it's Paula Deen here. Now, if you're like me, there's nothing you love any better than spending time with family and friends.
Remember Jared from Subway? He's inspired a lot of people.
He's looking good.
This is fat-free Jell-O instant pudding. The box says it's fat-free, but let's see what my taste buds have to say.
So now companies invest sometimes heavily in disgrace insurance. These are niche policies that can be worth tens of millions of dollars, and they're intended to help cover financial costs when a celebrity endorser goes off the rails. And I'm just wondering, if you were a celebrity that got paid for endorsements, how much coverage would you need? Let's start with you, Tamika. You're a marketing communication strategist.
Yikes. Well, you know, I think I'm going this way. I'm going to choose a low threshold with the idea that I would continue to live my life in a way that avoids the pitfall of having to use it. But kind of like the approach I use with my auto insurance, better have it, better have some coverage, never know when you'll need to use it.
Okay. Amber?
Yeah, no, I think my sponsors would be okay.
So far, though, you're
so
quite
far,
young.
It's true. But yeah, I mean, for better or for worse, my life isn't that
would not cost
exciting.
Millions, maybe $100 policy.
Right,
okay,
yeah,
B?
I think pretty well.
You know, I'm a little bit of a troublemaker, and I'm not going to incriminate myself. But compared to the clips that you just aired, I'm going to say I'm on a low threshold.
A couple hundred thousand? Give me a number here.
I have to plead the fifth.
Jeff?
Well, what bothered me was I think Nancy called right away to see what quote she could get. What I told her was I think you need to check into boredom insurance.
Oh, no.
Because I'm so dull and boring. But it is a funny concept, and it's interesting. You can almost insure anything now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Models insure right. parts of their body. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about pets. Pet owners in the United States spend about $35 billion a year on their dogs and cats. And those pets, let's be honest, are often considered a beloved member of the family. And when a pet dies, that can be very difficult. So in order to give grieving employees time to cope with that loss, some companies now allow up to 3 days bereavement after a pet dies. And I wonder what you guys think of this. Is this something you would take advantage of? And do you think it's a... I mean, we're not saying all companies. These happen to be companies that are capable of doing it. But what do you think? Good benefit?
I think it's great. I mean, the way I see it is, and I'm a big... Let me just... Big dog person. And Todd Rehm, who's a frequent guest at GPB, does a lot of dog work at Georgia Pundit. And, you know, I think... That's the beauty of free enterprise and capitalism. If it works for that company and they can provide that for their employees and it makes it a better place to work, then I think it's great. Would I do it personally? I mean, we just lost our baby a couple of years ago, and she had been with us 11 years, and it was on my birthday, and it killed me. I don't know that I would necessarily take the 3 days, but I think it's great if a boss can offer that to improve the work environment.
If I had it, I might take 1 day, Tamika.
I might take 1 day. I like it. And it's interesting because I've had a dog now for 5 years. And prior to that, I will say that maybe my opinion would have been different because, you know, I just didn't sort of have this understanding of how these animals can
be attached to cats.
You know, I'm doing things I never even thought I would do before, like going to a dog park and, you know, dropping my dog off at my vet when I'm going out of town. I mean, you know, that was something that I would not have done previously because I come from a place where dogs lived outside and were more thought of as in the wild and could take care of themselves.
As just animals.
As
yeah.
just animals.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great. So, full disclosure, I don't have a pet.
Right.
So, but I mean, I do know that they do become part of your family, and so I can understand mourning for that. And I do think it's great, to your point, that some companies are trying to understand, appreciate what their workers are going through. But at the same time, part of me is like, we don't even have mandated maternity leave in this country. So I kind of feel like we should be prioritizing, you know, leave and creating policies around things that might be, you know, a little
a fair
bit
point.
More of a priority.
These particular companies that are offering this do have maternity
They already
leave.
Have, right.
B?
Pets are people too. That's my slogan. So if companies are in that position, I'm all for it. And would I take it? I don't know. I once stayed at home from work because I was reading a book that was so good I couldn't put it down. So, you know?
Okay, fair enough. This is, I'm sure, something that those of you out there who have pets would weigh in on, that whether it be a dog or a cat. So let us know if you would actually, if it was available at your company, would you take pet bereavement time? Let us know at 404-500-9457 or tweet us at OST Talk. Okay, let's move on to climate change. There was a study published recently that says rising sea levels may force more than 13 million people in the U.S. to relocate by the end of the century. The areas in the most danger include the waterfront regions of coastal Georgia. The report claims the relocation effort could actually resemble or outpace the Great Migration, that was the move of Southern African Americans in the 20th century north, west, and east. It also points out that southeastern coastal states, like us, account for almost 70% of the at-risk population. So the question is, do reports like this, do we think that they will finally spur action on climate change?
Yeah, I think our society tends to be one where we make changes and we make policies and we do things when emergencies are happening. Like when it's happening right now, that's when we start acting.
When the water starts coming into
right,
people's homes.
Right, right. No, and it's a shame because, you know, people, we've been talking about, this has been an issue for decades. Like people have been predicting it and we kind of constantly have this conversation around, well, what are we going to do? And we still don't really make any real actions to change things. So I think it's not going to be until we're walking outside in waist deep water that it's going to be a real problem.
Unfortunately, it's become a political issue, so nothing is going to happen right now given our political climate. There's no way that we're going to come together on climate change, unfortunately, no matter how much evidence is presented, because right now there's so much polarization that anything that's political, it's not going to happen.
That's depressing.
Yeah,
yes.
There's so much divide in the global climate debate and fracture in, you know, sort of national and global efforts. They're not collective. We haven't woven together the quilt to really make an impact. And I don't know how much more evidence we need. I remember the flood in Georgia just a few years ago and friends who were deeply impacted by that. And I mean, New Orleans, I mean, and then what's happening in Miami, where they're seeing evidence and trying to build the sidewalks higher. You know, how much more evidence do we need?
Jeff, did you want to weigh in? You're looking really cautious over there.
I think you have to look at it from two perspectives. The political, the international, the whole world, you know, when is India and China going to step up and sign some treaties that the Obama administration has said they're willing to sign? I mean, it's got to be a global solution, not just a United States solution. And secondly, if you subscribe to this a premise and you live in the impacted area of the study, it's not a government solution. It's your solution.
I mean, to move.
Are you going to move or not? Because if you don't move, maybe you don't really believe it. And then are you going to sit there and say, we're going to wait to a catastrophic emergency and rely on the taxpayers of the United States to spend
a lot of money to move
us out of here? So if you really believe in it and you're in the area, you need to take some personal responsibility and do some stuff.
Fair enough. It is Friday. We're hanging out in the break room. You just heard Jeff Breedlove. He works with DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester. B. Wynn is at Athena's Warehouse. Tamika DePriest is a marketing strategist. Amber Scott is with the nonprofit Leap Year. Let's talk about another thing, which has, I guess, become politicized. the thing is that America is lagging pretty far behind our other first world nations when it comes to gender equality. Recently, three delegates from the UN, United Nations, came here. They were coming to study gender equality here. And they all three report that they were horrified by what they observed. They focused on restrictions on women's health, female gun deaths in domestic violence cases, and the lack of political representation for women. They say there was a major red flags. I know the political representation is particularly difficult here in Georgia. But why are we lagging so far behind other countries? First world nations here we're talking about. Why?
Okay.
And silence. Let's move on to the next.
Okay, it's 4-1.
It is.
So I'll from a male perspective. I read that article, and I appreciate the delegates coming to do their
due diligence.
What I think is, it's up to the ladies, the women of America, to respond to a study like this in the way that works for them. I mean, I'm not saying they're right or wrong in their observations, but I would suggest that their observations. I'm sure they interviewed people in the three states they went to, which were pretty diverse states. But at the same time, at the end of the day, you're not going to have the United Nations find a solution. Everything, the beauty of America is that, you know, we just referenced Mayor Shirley Franklin. We were the front runner for the Democrat nomination for president is female. Some people are saying her vice presidential selection will be a senator from Massachusetts who's female. We could have two females at the head of a major party ticket. So I don't know that it's as gloom and doom as they said it was, but I respect their observations, and I think that it's up to the people of America to find that solution, not the people of the United Nations.
Well, certainly, just because
now the women want to talk.
Right. I mean, certainly, just because Hillary Clinton is a leader in a presidential case doesn't mean that there aren't gender problems in this country. Surely, and
well, Obama is the president, and there's no more race problems.
That is true.
Exactly.
we're just teasing you, Jeff. You are outnumbered. It's going to happen.
Okay, and I'm thinking about that social media study. We just sort of talked about in this segment. But I think at the end of the day, yeah, we can look at a lot of things that women have impacted, like being the fastest growing demographic in the workplace and in higher education and, you know, our influence in communities. But at the end of the day, patriarchy rules. We are still dealing with the yoke of, you know, the whole founding fathers concept. And yes, I do have my women's studies lens on here, so sorry to go in deep, but that's the reality. And I think
poor
in
Jeff.
Other places there's this ability to sort of move sometimes back and forth between what I would call matriarchal concepts and patriarchal concepts. Like I think of the queen.
Let me let
in
B,
England,
we're gonna have to move on, so let me let B come in here.
In our very own state, we consistently are rated a D for political participation and for policies that empower women economically and provide that stability. And in fact, I'm going to be an opportunist this legislative session. We've been working very hard to get a bill passed to get rape kits audited, counted, and submitted in a timely protocol within 30 days to GBEI. And that bill was killed. And it was voted unanimously through the House. And we can't even get a bill like that passed. We have some major issues, and we need to talk about it.
Okay, and on that, let's move on to Chris Christie and Donald Trump. Look, regardless of what your politics are, we can't deny this is a pretty interesting election year, right? Donald Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee at this point, and a couple former opponents have stepped up to endorsement. Jeff's not buying that either. It includes a surprising and enthusiastic nod of support from New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. This came as a surprise to some, including myself, considering Christie's former stance on Trump.
Donald's a great guy and a good person, but I just don't think he's suited to be president of the United States.
Why?
I don't think his temperament is suited for that, and I don't think his experience is.
Okay. One commentator speculated Trump may be blackmailing Christie, and Hillary Clinton wondered aloud if Christie owed Trump money. That was during an MSNBC commercial break. Why do we think Christie changed his mind? Let me go with you, Jeff, because this is your party.
For full disclosure, I've endorsed, and so has Nancy, Ted Cruz, so I don't want any Trump supporters to think I'm taking a cheap shot at him. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, I have no idea if the man's in debt or what his relationship is with Donald Trump. I will say that one of the most fascinating primaries in our lifetime to me was the Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton one. The debates were great. It was great politics. And it got pretty vicious with a former president of the United States talking about racism against Barack Obama. And she ended up as the Secretary of State in that administration. Politics does amazing things to former
strange
adversaries.
Strange bedfellows.
So I think it's a bipartisan situation. I think, to me, it's disappointing that Governor Christie endorsed Donald Trump. I wish he had endorsed Ted Cruz. But I don't know that it's nefarious. It's
but
just,
it could be. Let's get anybody else think there's something going on?
I think everything in politics is nefarious. And if I were endorsing Trump, I would also look very uncomfortable doing it, too.
Yeah, I mean, it's I do agree. Politics, there's always backdoor deals. And we recently heard about Ben Carson, who, you know, also endorsed him and kind of insinuated that
he was offered
a position.
Cabinet position, yeah.
So we know that in politics,
which is illegal.
Right, apparently. And to say that on the media, you know. Yeah. But, you know, so it seems like a lot of that is happening, and it's a lot more blatant with this candidate, which makes it really concerning.
I see more similarities between the two. I mean, I actually think they have similar temperaments, and I think they both have the spirit of competition, and I think Christie looks at Trump as a winner, even though his outer doesn't.
Really quick, Jeff.
As we go out, I got to say this. My wife thought that Mike Lukovich at the AJC drew one of his most classic cartoons when he did the one with Trump standing behind him and Obama saying, "We're doing all that we can to get you out."
That's a great
Mike Lukovich cartoon.
Yeah, trying to rescue Chris Christie. We're out of time in the break room. I want to say thank you to all my guests. Amber Scott is the executive director of the nonprofit Leap Year. Tamika DePriest, marketing and communications strategist. Jeff Breedlove, communications director for DeKalb County Commissioner Nancy Jester. And Bee Nguyen is the executive director of the nonprofit Athena's Warehouse. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.